from Tukito LLC. It's Keto Woman Podcast with Daisy Brackenhall.
Hello, Keto Lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight, after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. Keto has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman Podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs to 20 grams or less per day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein, scale to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalised keto. I'll be asking my guest each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history and so have access to the bigger picture. This week's extraordinary woman is Nina Teicholz. Nina is an investigative science journalist and author. Her international bestseller, The Big Fat Surprise, has upended the conventional wisdom on dietary fat, especially saturated fat. The executive editor of The Lancet wrote, "This is a disquieting book about ruthless silencing of dissent that has shaped our lives for decades. Researchers, clinicians, and health policy advisors should read this provocative book." The Big Fat Surprise was named a 2014 Best Book by The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Mother Jones, and Library Journal. Nina is also the executive director of the Nutrition Coalition, a non-profit group that promotes evidence-based nutrition policy. She is a graduate of Stanford and Oxford universities and previously served as associate director of the Center for Globalization and Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Nina now lives in New York City with her husband and two sons. What a great pleasure it was to talk to Nina about her book. The chapter about how women and children fare on a low-fat diet has some shocking facts, and I wanted to explore these further. I hope you enjoy this episode and encourage you to read Nina's book if you haven't already. It's a credit to her writing skills that it reads as a thriller which keeps you on the edge of your seat, as well as having you shouting in outrage at some of the outrageous machinations that have gone on over the years behind the scenes. Welcome, Nina, to the Keto Woman Podcast. It's lovely to be talking to you today.
Well, lovely to be talking to you too. Thank you.
Perhaps you could set the scene for what led you to write The Big Fat Surprise. You grabbed me right away with the first sentence of your book. I remember the day I stopped worrying about fat.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, fat is really what we all have spent most of our lives, most of us, you know, obsessing about, right? How much fat, non-fat, and low fat. I mean, when I was a child, I grew up with whole fat milk and my grandmother's Russian meatballs and sour cream sauce. But then we went through this sort of transition that many families did. It was like, you know, the anti-fat police came through the house. My mother decided she was killing us all with those, feeding us that way. So we all started having non-fat milk and we stopped, well, we greatly reduced the amount of meat that we ate and we stopped really eating much butter. And so, you know, and that was really my life in my teens and 20s and 30s and eating that way, eating kind of a high carbohydrate, low fat diet, like we've all been told, faithfully adhering to that diet, poaching my fish, no oil on the fish, no sauce on anything. Sauce was verboten. And it wasn't until I started doing research for this book in the early 2000s. And really the first thing that I learned was that I looked at all the studies on the low fat diet, people following exactly the kind of diet that I had been following. And on, big, huge, long, multi-year, multi-center studies. And I realized that, wow, that diet, they could never show that diet helped at all. Didn't help people lose weight, fight cancer, fight heart disease, fight diabetes, nothing. So that was quite a revelation. I mean, in some ways it's a confirmation so I'm not alone. It's not my fault that I'm not, following this faithfully enough. It just doesn't seem to work. And then coming across the literature, the growing scientific literature on people who ate diets that were higher in fat and lower in carbohydrates a little bit, and how much better the outcomes in those studies looked. Really now a sizable body of scientific literature showing people who eat more fat and cut back on their carbs a little bit, actually they look better. Their cholesterol levels look better. They lost more weight. Their blood sugars went down. And so that was what convinced me, and I do remember kind of one of the exact moments where I'm looking at a roasted chicken in a pan and looking at all the drippings in the pan, which I loved as a child, and thinking, wow, I'm just going to take a spoon and I'm going to drink some of those and that's going to be okay. And I would say it wasn't, for some people, they find out this knowledge and it's just like from one day to the next, they're like, boom, okay, I get it. I'm changing my diet 100%. But for me, it was just a much slower, longer process of changing how I ate.
And I hated it. All those years where fat was the devil, you mentioned roast chicken and the skin for me, the fattier dark meat and the skin has always been something that I loved. I could strip off the whole lot of the skin and just eat that. I love it. And I just spent so many years feeling guilty for eating that and spending so many years stripping it off and throwing it away. And I can remember binging on it one day because I was there diligently stripping it all off and about to throw it away. And I just couldn't. I just had to cram it all in my mouth because it was so delicious. And now, these are the foods that we can enjoy. And they make us healthy. I mean, it sounds too good to be true, but it is.
Yeah. Well, and I think that word that you say, guilt, is really really the sort of major psychological shift for so many people because, especially for women, your relationship with food is just principally guilt for decades, right? Like, how many calories did I eat this morning and how many this afternoon and can I eat that and can I better not eat that? And if I eat that, I feel so guilty and just always failing because it's a diet that's set up to fail, right? And so you are always hungry. So it's always, you're always in that pit of guilty despair that you've sort of ruined the day, right, by overeating. And so I think it's just so liberating then to shift to this new way of eating where you can really trust your body. You can trust it to eat as much as it wants and not feel guilty. Not feel guilty about being hungry, not feel guilty about eating when you're hungry, and then you're full. And that's it. And you're like, wow, that's the way people used to live for millennia. It's
exactly. And what's so devastating as well, when you're talking about this guilt and this shame that you say that we're sort of set up to fail. But when we do fail, in quotation marks, we blame ourselves. That's right. The first and usually the only thing we think of doing. Well, I must have done something wrong. It must have been that slight cheat I had the other day, or when I went 50 calories over, or it's me who's failing. I need to adhere to the diet better. It never crosses our mind that it's the diet that's at fault.
Right. Well, that's also what we're told by our expert community and our doctors. They look at you and you sit there in the doctor's office and you're 20 pounds overweight and they're like, well, what's wrong with you? And how come you didn't follow the diet that I told you to? And you think, well, I must have failed. You're right. And it must have been that binge on whatever 50 calories I had over. We're taught that it is our fault. It's tragic and unjust on so many levels. But, one of the things that I find really saddest now is that women particularly are what's known in the scientific literature as adherers. We follow rules, particularly when it comes to diet, because we desperately want to be thin. Being thin is so important for women. And so we do follow the rules. We convince ourselves that, you know, salad with vinegar and no oil, that's really all I want, and I'm happy with that. We adhere to the rules. We are the ones who most faithfully follow the diet that we've been told. And white women are experiencing the greatest declines in life expectancy in the United States. I don't know about in Europe too, but I mean, that's very sad. That really, to me, says we most religiously follow the low fat diet, and now we're suffering for it.
Yes, that's what strikes me, is that not only has following the guidelines that we've been told not worked, but it's gone the other way in potentially doing us harm.
Well, that was sort of one of the most shocking things that I found when I was researching my book as a woman and reading about the literature, the scientific literature on women. I mean, one thing you realize is that women have probably been particularly harmed by the low-fat diet, not only because we follow it most religiously, but also because it turns out in scientific experiments that when women reduce fat, and anytime anybody reduces fat, what they do is they increase carbohydrates, right? So instead of bacon and eggs for breakfast, you're having cereal. And instead of meat for dinner, you're having pasta or grains of some kind. And that's what we were told to do. And in experiments, when they compare men and women who do that, everybody sees their good cholesterol drop. That's a sign of worsening heart disease risk. But for women, that drop is even greater. Which is to say that for women, their cardiovascular risk goes up even more on a low-fat diet, worse for women than for men. And that, of course, that result was, the difference for women was, of course, ignored. And it's part of a theme, really, of women's health outcomes, which are different from men's, being ignored consistently from the beginning. It turns out that for women, for middle-aged women, the higher your cholesterol, and this was known in the late 70s, the higher your cholesterol, the longer you were likely to live. So, and that's just one of the results that was just sort of ignored, swept under the rug, too complicated. Let's just have the you know, results for men apply to everybody because for whatever reason. And so, you know, how many women go to their doctor and the doctor says, high cholesterol? Good on you. You'll live a long life.
Exactly. Nobody's heard that. I mean, that's what I found so shocking throughout the book. I was rereading it via audiobook, so I was listening to it while I was gardening, and I was literally shouting out loud with rage. Just the general foundations that the ADA advice and recommendations are based on are so shaky, and it just seems absolutely flabbergasting that these foundations that are so shaky are then extrapolated to include women and children and end up being potentially damaging.
Yeah, it is truly like maybe one of the, you know, it's possibly like worse than any war crime. It's what's been inflicted on people, the suffering that, if you think about that, our guidelines very likely fueled the obesity and diabetes epidemics, if not actually caused them. And, you know, in the beginning, it's sort of understandable that they, you know, in the 1950s in America, there's just a panic over the rising tide of heart disease had come from pretty much out of nowhere in the early part of the century. Suddenly, the number one killer, everybody's in a panic and they don't know what causes heart disease. And so it's sort of understandable at that point that in steps this one scientist, Ansel Keys, who says, well, it's saturated fat and dietary cholesterol that cause heart disease. That's the answer. And I think one can sort of understand in that context how, say, the American Heart Association then adopts that and says, well, this is our best guess. We have to tell the public something.
Yeah. You've got to start somewhere.
you just can't say nothing on this subject that you're supposed to be an expert on. And so they adopted this idea and told everybody to eat less meat and cheese and less shellfish, because no egg yolks, that's all, you know, too much cholesterol, because that caused heart disease. And I think no one could have imagined that that, you know, advice first issued in 1961 would become this huge dogma that then spread around the world and that nobody could ever reverse out of. I mean, what's less understandable is that, you know, from that day in 1961 onwards, in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, you know, they tested this idea that fat and saturated fat cause any kind of disease at all. And, you know, in the beginning, the science was really shaky, right? Of course, that's true of the 1950s, hardly any science done. But then they did all these in the 60s, 70s, 80s, they do all these huge clinical trials, the gold standard of evidence, funded by governments, multi-center with tens of thousands of people. All those trials are done. None of them can confirm this hypothesis. None of them show that saturated fat and dietary cholesterol have any effect on your cardiovascular mortality or on your total mortality. The low-fat studies don't show any benefit of that diet. And yet, and this is where it sort of just ceases to be understandable and where you do start, like, you know, with your bootless cries to the heavens above, like, well, and how is it that they could not reverse out of this advice? If they cannot confirm it, they test it rigorously over and over and over again, and they cannot confirm. And it looks like it's actually doing harm.
Exactly. It seemed to me that there was this real problem with egos going on. You know, the egos of people who'd put forward these hypotheses and just didn't want to back down regardless. It just sounds like they refused to listen to anything coming in that came anywhere close to refuting their ideas. They just shut them down. I mean, like Yudkin in Britain was shut down, wasn't he, with coming up with, actually, you know, perhaps it's not fat, it's sugar that's the problem. Everyone, it seemed these people got so big and so powerful that they couldn't be refuted.
Yes, and so, you know, it's individual egos, and then there's the politics of science, right? So that once this one hypothesis, this one idea becomes institutionalized, adopted by every public health institution, adopted by the government, then it's impossible to reverse out of it. They've been telling the public this, that public would lose trust in them, maybe the public would sue them for making them fat and sick. And so you have the institutionalization of these hypotheses, and then these results would come out. I mean, imagine in the 1960s, the results comes out from the biggest ever test of saturated fats that they cause heart disease. And the results are, you know, after 5.5 years of this experiment, the results are no effect. People who had the soy milk and the soy filled cheese and the soy burgers, they did not see any reduction in cardiovascular risk after 5 years on this diet. And it was a pretty well done study. It was done in mental hospitals, so it was pretty well controlled because they were feeding everybody all their food instead of just letting them roam free. At the end of that study, that was called the Minnesota Coronary Survey, they didn't publish those results for 16 years. And then when they did publish them, finally, they put them in this out-of-the-way journal that they knew that nutrition scientists wouldn't read. And then, you know, much later, when a journalist asked them, the leaders of the study, well, why didn't you publish your results? They said, well, there was nothing wrong with the study. It was a government-funded study. But we were just so disappointed in the way it came out. So, and just the other week, a friend of that project investigator, who's now deceased, but a friend of his who's still active, said to me, you know, the reality is, if they had published their study, he told me, you know, he would never be able to get another government grant. He wouldn't be able, he'd be disinvited from sort of conferences. He just could no longer be a scientist, because at some point, an idea takes such strong hold in, you know, say our national institutes of health or your government. And then there, it just results to the contrary are so disruptive and contradictory, and they just have to be denied or ignored or not published or left in a basement. In that particular study, researchers in the last few years actually went into the project leader's basement where he had stored, you know, those magnetic tapes where they keep data. And they looked at the data on the magnetic tapes and they found there had been data that actually had never been published, showing that the more these men and women in the experiment had lowered their cholesterol, the more likely they were to die early of a heart attack.
Wow. So, I mean, this is not just potential embarrassment. This is people dying.
Yeah. And this is, you know, basically still going on today, which is that studies that come out with contradictory results are just ignored. You know, I'll give you the most recent example. In, you know, there's a big body of literature now supporting the use of a lower carbohydrate diet than the one we're recommended. We're recommended to eat 50 to 55% of our calories as carbohydrates, mainly grains. And really, there's now more than 70 of these gold standard randomized controlled clinical trials that say that a low carb diet is better. So what happened when our experts were supposed to review all the literature, both in the UK and in the US, they just completely ignored those trials. They just didn't include them. They, in the case of the US, I actually have emails from the expert committee saying, you know, there's this huge body of literature on low carb. We should do something with it. And one of them says, let's stuff it in the methodology section. And, you know, and somebody else pipes up and says, you know, I don't think we should be burying it there. Literally uses the word burying it. And then that conversation just sort of ends. So it's still going on today. And that's why, you know, I think in the end, there really is something of a cover up story here about just ignoring the science that contradicts the official advice.
Exactly. And you touched on it before, but the chapter in the book that had me raging the most was when you focused in on women and children and the studies that they'd done with them and mostly ignored or pretended they didn't exist somehow. And perhaps we could talk a bit more about those, because I found those results really shocking.
Yeah, I when people tell me they get so angry reading my book that they have to put it down. And they almost always talk about the women and children section. And that's because all this advice that was designed for middle-aged men to avoid heart disease was then just rolled out for women and children based on zero evidence, right? They just decided to rope in women and children. You know, there the argument was, well, we'll target the entire population. And then if we can bring, you know, numbers of cardiovascular death down in the entire population, that will make sense without really, which is a crazy argument when you think that, you know, not only they understood that women had a different, you know, developed heart disease in a different way, but also children have completely different nutritional needs. Children need to grow and be healthy. They are not, their number one priority is not to be fighting cardiovascular disease at age two. But that was actually the thinking.
Exactly. The sentence that jumped out to me was this obsession with starting out in a position of defense, like we need to prevent against cardiovascular disease from the minute they're born, which is crazy. No, you need to be focusing on making them strong and healthy and grow well.
Right. I know. And that thinking was, you have to understand, well, so first of all, so it's all middle-aged men doing the science.
Which is shaky in the first place.
Which is shaky in the first place. But, you know, they wanted to, you know, they still want to do this. They wanted to put children as young as three on cholesterol-lowering drugs. There's still an effort to try to put all children on statins. So it's just a bit of craziness in the, you know, because first of all, they were wrong about the diet that prevents cardiovascular disease to begin with, and then to impose that wrong diet on children for whom they have different priorities. Their priorities are growth. So they did test, you know, there eventually were a few clinical trials that I tracked down that had been done on children, but none of them were on normal populations. One of them was on children who had like exceptionally high LDL cholesterol. That's your bad cholesterol. And that's because they had some kind of, you know, that's a genetic condition. But they used that study and tried to generalize it to all children based on this small, unusual group of children with a genetic problem. And then in another study, you know, they compared this cholesterol lowering diet where all the children were on soy milk or whatever, and they to children growing healthfully, and they found that the children on this alternative diet did grow okay, but they had to give them, you know, huge, all these vitamin supplements, and you know, it wasn't a natural healthy diet. And when I started to look at, you know, the available data on growth statistics around the world and comparing different countries, it was quite clear that children on lower fat diets really did not grow, do not grow as well in these countries. You know, it was really the data looking internationally, it was really the children having, you know, high milk and meat diets, you know, the German children who were the tallest, mm-hmm. And looked the healthiest. And, you know, now we know that really children do need more fat to grow. And crucially, children need nutrients and minerals and vitamins to grow well, right? So just to give a tiny example, children need choline for the development of their brains, and they need lutein for the development of their eyes. And where are those two nutrients in abundance? In the yolk of an egg, not in the egg white. For all those people having egg white omelets, yeah. And you know, oh, imposing those on their children, it's in the yolk. Mm. All the nutrients of the egg are in the yolk. Similarly, you know, meat is an incredibly nutrient dense food. Liver is the most nutrient dense food on the planet. Clams have like an incredibly high level of vitamin B12, which is crucial for the healthy growth of children. So we've all been ignoring this, and we've been told to put our children on, you know, to follow the same kind of high grain diet that with low fat. And you know, I think that our children, as a result, it's sad. I mean, the levels of disease that we see now. I was just saying to somebody the other day, I looked at my child, who's my younger child, has grown up on, since I've written my book, you know, he grows up, he eats a lot of animal foods. And I noticed like he had just tremendously rosy cheeks, especially compared to all of his classmates. And I thought, oh, you know, rosy cheeked, that's like a book out of the, you know, 1700s, or, you know, children used to be rosy cheeked, but they really aren't anymore. I think it's because of the way we eat differently.
Yes. And it still seems to be that way. I mean, I've noticed certainly my niece and nephews, their parents have been giving them, you know, whole milk and high fat foods. But I do notice that a lot of the snacks, especially as they start getting older, are very low fat. You know, it's things like rice cakes and all these low fat, high grain foods that do still dominate the shelves.
Well, or, you know, or like little fruity snacks, like little gel fruits, or even just too much fruit in general. If you choose, you know, fruit as every snack, that's quite a lot of fructose that is adding up. You know, there's growing epidemic of children with fatty liver disease. Why is that? Well, fructose goes directly to your liver to be processed. Your liver, I mean, it's actually healthier to have a snack of cheese, will fill you up, lower in sugar. You know, dare I say, even, you know, salami is a great nutrient-dense snack, fills you up, does not cause cancer. For children, really, I think they are, you know, there's a heavy fallout there that we're experiencing. And it is one way that I think people, even if for themselves they feel like they can't change their diet or there's too much cognitive dissonance, but for their children, they can see that maybe there's a different way for them to eat. And really, you can just go back and read some you know, read your Jane Austen, or go back and read, you know, even you read books from the 50s, the kids are all having bacon and eggs for breakfast. And just remember, that's before the obesity and diabetes epidemics. You know, now we have a study to say children who grew up on whole milk grow up to be slimmer than those who grew up with non-fat, low-fat milk.
Yeah, certainly that's what my grandmother always wanted to give me for breakfast, bacon and eggs.
Well, I grew up on like sugary cereals, and I became so afraid of the fat and milk that I just put water in them. Like, I think about the way I grew up. I'm convinced I'd be 5 inches taller if I had like not grown up on that diet.
Yes, because I mean, it does really show in their growth, doesn't it? I thought it was interesting that the study that's mentioned in the book that compares infants in Gambia versus in Cambridge in the United Kingdom, where they were on different diets, and there was a difference, wasn't it, there in their growth development?
Yes. I mean, so the infants in Gambia, I think, were on something like a 12 or 13% fat diet, and they really just, there was a failure to thrive that's consistently found, that was consistently found worldwide in countries anywhere where the fat percentage of fat consumption fell below about 23-24%, there was, you would see a failure to thrive in those children, compared to over 40% fat that was found in Germany, if I'm remembering correctly. In the United States, in 1965, according to our best statistics, we were eating 43% fat. So we were all on a high-fat diet in 1965. And again, that's before the epidemics of obesity and diabetes. So we've just undergone this massive macronutrient shift. Macronutrients, I mean, you know, we've massively reduced fat and increased carbohydrates. So we eat 30% more carbohydrates than we did in 1970. That's a huge shift. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is increasingly, we understand that as the shift that's really propelled along obesity and diabetes.
Exactly. And the two big studies that were done on women, and you touched on before about the study that showed the decrease in HDL, and I think there was also an increase in triglycerides, which significantly increases the risk of heart attack. It was the Boeing study, I believe, that was one of the places that was discovered. And they had a male group and a female group. But as you mentioned, the female group really seemed to do far, far worse on it than the men did.
Yes. So this is a study. It's what I call one of those silent studies that come out, the results are not what are expected, and nobody talks about them. So they just sort of disappear. They never reviewed, they're not included in review papers, they're not reviewed for any of our guidelines, they just disappear. And I actually spoke to the man who led those studies, Robert Knopp, and he said he just couldn't understand it. He did these two. They were funded by the National Institutes of Health. They were big studies, 300, 400 people, one on men and one on women. They were Boeing employees. They were done in Seattle. And they were well done studies. And at the end of them, they just showed that the low fat diet had basically been a debacle. There had been no benefits in terms of weight loss and the cardiovascular outcomes. They were able to bring down the total cholesterol a little bit, but they also saw really quite significant drops in the good cholesterol coming down. And that drop for the women was much worse than it was for the men. So, and as you say, triglycerides were rising because triglycerides are just fatty acids in your blood, and they are a direct relation to how much carbs you're eating. So it's carbs that turn into fat in your blood, right? I mean, it seems like, oh, it would be fat turns into fat, but that's not the way it is. Like,
yeah, not fat. It's not fat that clogs your arteries.
It's carbs that convert into fat. And so the women saw those triglycerides, their fatty acids go up, their good cholesterol fall, both signs of worsening cardiovascular risk, and they saw their outcomes looked worse than men. And that, of course, should have been, there should have been on the front page of every newspaper in the country. Women, the low-fat diet is dangerous for you. You will increase your risk of a heart attack. And, of course, what do we see in our country? We see heart disease rising in among women. You know, it used to be a disease among men, but women have caught up. because we're so good at following the low-fat diet. You know, we're like the best adherers to the low-fat diet. And as a result, we get the prize, more heart disease. And we are the fastest, white women, middle-aged women have the fastest decrease in life expectancy in the United States.
Which is shocking.
Which is shocking.
Wasn't it him as well that actually put forward a suggestion that maybe low-carb diets would be a healthier option for women?
Yes.
which presumably was completely ignored.
Completely ignored. Really, this is a story more of politics than science, right? So that really ended his career as a scientist. So, you publish studies like that and you come out and really speak at all forcefully about their results that run completely contrary to the accepted conventional wisdom. And he was punished for that. And what I mean in science being punished is you don't get another research grant. You aren't invited to conferences. You have trouble getting your studies published. He just sort of faded from relevancy in his field. And that's really what happened to all those scientists in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And then the next generation of scientists really just self-censored. They saw what happened to the generation before them, and then they just stopped. Like, well, I'm not touching fat because, you know, that's a sure way to end my career. And in fact, when I started off my work doing research and calling up scientists in the early 2000s, I would pick up the phone and talk to people, and they would literally say, if you're going to talk about fat, I can't even have this conversation.
I must admit, as I was reading the book, I was surprised at how many quotes you did get for that reason. You did get a lot of people to talk to you.
Yeah, now I don't think I could sort of come out of the closet. But, you know, I mean, I think people should talk about their research. I mean, it is, you know, I did have quite a few people hang up on me when I would challenge them, because one of the things that scientists do is they, you know, I think that you could, I don't want to say lie, but they, you know, they don't represent their data at all in their conclusions. Their data says one thing and their conclusion says something totally different. And then when you would confront them on that, I did have scientists actually hang up on me, you know, how dare you? But, you know, you, it's just inconceivable that this could be science. This is the science that is guiding us. And these are the experts to whom we trust. But the science really is it just doesn't, it's nothing like the sort of science we would expect. So it is disheartening, but it has taught me now to pretty much distrust almost all nutrition science that I read and be very skeptical about it. Because in addition, something that we haven't even talked about is the whole influence of the food industry, you know, which pays for science, and they pay to influence the science, and then they pay, you know, they find their way into all kinds of they pay for websites to disseminate the science. I mean, there's just the heavy hand of the food companies in this whole story as well.
Exactly. And when they're funding science, you know, how can you completely believe the findings? But another study that I wanted to mention, because it's talked about a lot in all sorts of areas, is the Women's Health Institute study.
Initiative. You
know, initiative. Yes, sorry.
Right.
That, you know, is huge and discussed a lot. And they actually did a significant and lengthy study on a huge number of women, didn't they, to look at the low-fat diet?
Yes. Yeah, so what happened is in the late 1980s, I believe, that there were a number of meetings talking about how there's no data on women. How can we advise this diet for all Americans when really we have no data on women? That is wrong. They were correct. So they launched the largest nutrition study ever in the history of nutrition studies, called the Women's Health Initiative, on almost 49,000 women. And they basically just gave the women a copy of the US dietary guidelines, that food pyramid. They told them, you know, decrease your fat, less saturated fat, less cholesterol, less meat, non-fat dairy products, margarine instead of butter. And they did this in a number of different centers around the country. It cost $700 million to do this portion of the study. The women stayed on this diet for almost 8 years on average. And at the end of that, they came out with, it was primarily a cancer study. That was the primary outcome, to see if that diet would prevent cancer, because it was thought that fat caused cancer. So they followed them long enough to see who would get cancer. At the end of that study, they published their results in 2006, and there were 5 major papers that came out of it. It turned out that study, that women who had been on that diet for all those years saw no benefits in terms of getting diabetes, no prevention of cardiovascular disease, no prevention for any kind of cancer. And they had followed them for 3 or 4 kinds of cancer. And they weighed like a pound less than the control group. And what happened after that study is that what happened to all these studies, they just found a way to dismiss it away. There was like, there was a whole long laundry list of things that must have gone wrong with it. You know, the women, the control group changed their diet along with the intervention group. So in the end, there weren't that many differences between them. Or there was just a whole long list of reasons that that study should be dismissed and ignored. And in fact, one of the things that I found out later when I went and researched our dietary guidelines was that no expert committee had ever, ever used the Women's Health Initiative to as evidence for formulating our dietary guidelines. In other words, that whole trial, which had been that cost $700 million of taxpayer money to inform our nutrition policy, had never been considered for our nutrition policy. So what should have happened, like those Boeing studies where they should have said, look, the low-fat diet clearly doesn't work. We've tested it. We've tried it. Randomized controlled clinical trial. That's the best kind of study science we can do. We should just end the low-fat diet. But they didn't. Instead, they just ignored it.
It's flabbergasting to me when I'm reading earlier in the book that studies that are far less comprehensive, that do conform to their bias, they do uphold the findings that they are expecting and want to find, are used and are upheld.
Yeah.
Yet these studies that are more substantial are completely ignored simply because they don't support what they want them to.
Yeah, you call it cherry picking one way of, and without getting too much in the weeds on the science, there is this weak kind of science called observational studies, which show association but not causation. So, and these observational studies can really be, it's very weak kind of data because instead of feeding people and actually looking, you know, with a control group, they just rely on what's this self-reported data. So, you know, you fill out what's called a food frequency questionnaire, and you say, well, how many peaches did you eat in the last 6 months? And how many plums? And then how many times did you have a piece of bread? Well, you know, nobody even remembers really what they ate yesterday. So, and this is over the last 6 months, you're supposed to accurately represent your diet. And that data has been shown, it's been tested and shown to be just so weak as to be, just not even worth the paper it's printed on. And so, but that kind of science, which is very weak, is basically, and it can be manipulated to show whatever is desired. That is the kind of science that is being used now to underpin our dietary guidelines because it can be made to conform to whatever biases the researchers have. And that's sort of a travesty.
You can pull something from it, can't you, in the fact that you can show if something doesn't happen, that
right.
You can find a link.
Yes.
So you can get
right,
some benefit.
Exactly. Right. So where you distrust the science is when things that are correlated, like caffeine is correlated with heart disease. Well, a lot of things are, you know, internet use is correlated with breast cancer. I mean, margarine consumption in Maine is correlated with divorce. I mean, you can find anything that correlates with anything. And if you do some fancy statistics, you can make those correlations look pretty much the way you want. The where you could trust those kinds of results is where there's a contradiction. So let's just take a relevant example. In the Women's Health Initiative study on those 49,000 women, the women significantly reduced their consumption of red meat, yet their cancer rates did not drop, right? So if meat caused cancer, you would see those lines. You would see dropping meat consumption, dropping cancer rates, but they don't. Those lines cross each other. Drop meat consumption goes down, cancer stays steady or goes up. So that's where you can sort of trust that data because there's a kind of contradiction there, right? I mean, I'll give you another one. The latest, biggest observational study ever to come out called PURE out of Canada. It's the first really, truly global observational study. They found that the less saturated fat people ate, the more likely they were to die of stroke. So that's a contradiction to our current guidelines. The more saturated fat you ate, the less likely you would die of stroke. That's a contradiction. That's not saying saturated fat causes something. It's saying it's a contradiction against our current advice. The other big finding from that study was, this is a correlation, but it's more, the more carbohydrates people ate, the more likely they were to die of heart disease. But now I'm going back on what I said, which is that's a correlation, so that doesn't show causation.
It's tricky, isn't it? But it does just go to show that there are some findings that you can pull out of such studies.
Yes, and that are useful. I mean, another big one, meat consumption in the U.S. has since 1970 has dropped by, red meat consumption dropped by 28%. In that time, diabetes has skyrocketed. Is it possible that meat can cause diabetes? Doesn't seem likely.
Exactly. When it goes the other way, what happens is that they often don't take into account the other factors. So, you know, something can increase, but they haven't taken into the account, you know, that people smoke or they don't exercise or there's this or there's that. And that's why you can't find correlation the other way, isn't it?
Yeah. And just to stay on the red meat topic, so in the studies where they find that red meat causes cancer or causes disease of any kind, what are you measuring in a red meat eater? You're measuring the people who have ignored their doctor's orders for the last 30 years, right? So those people tend to be heavier. They tend to exercise less. They tend to smoke more. They do everything wrong because, you know, number one thing your doctor tells you to do if you're at risk of heart disease or any kind of is to reduce your meat consumption. That's been true for decades now. So what you're measuring are unhealthy people who are unhealthy in so many ways you can't even begin to measure. Maybe they don't visit their parents and, you know, maybe they don't have any friends and maybe they, you know, maybe they're just down on their luck. Maybe they don't get enough sleep. I mean, there's so many things that you can't measure and you can't, what's called in science, adjust for them. So you really don't know what you're seeing. They're called confounders. And so the idea that red meat causes these diseases based on that kind of data is just not really credible. And that's actually the foundation of that IARC, the WHO decision that red meat causes cancer. They found a tiny, tiny, tiny association between red meat and cancer. But, you know, if you were to be honest about it and to say, like, those are basically unhealthy people, you really don't know if that's a real result. And that's why that finding is actually quite disputed.
Mm-hmm. Because you could pick out any of the other health factors and
right.
Equally problematic or not.
Right.
What kind of impact did you find that this incredible book had? I mean, you know, did you find that you became a bit of a pariah?
Well, you know, I expected it to be controversial, and it was controversial in ways that were good and hard, but mainly good. I mean, I think that it really was the first comprehensive book or article or really anything to say, you know, these are all the arguments for how we got it wrong on saturated fats. And it's changed the debate on saturated fats. Like, it's now almost impossible to talk about saturated fats without saying, you know, this is a subject of dispute now. So I think the book had a really good impact in changing the whole conversation. We don't, you know, before my book came out, I remember tracking all the articles on saturated fat. There was like nothing there. And now, you know, it's quite common for people to read something about, hey, maybe bacon's not so bad for you. Maybe, you know, maybe lard even. So it's changed the conversation, but it's, you know, what, anytime you're like the pointy tip of a spear of a movement, like you do, I mean, there's definitely been a lot of attacks on me personally. And even that is, you know, I try to look at that, although it's painful, like a little bit on the bright side, like, look, if they could attack my arguments, then they wouldn't go after me personally. But now really the only argument they have against me is, oh, well, she's just a journalist, or she's just out to sell books, or she must get paid by the meat industry. You know, those are classic old time arguments that have been used really since the 60s and 70s in nutrition science to try to undermine anybody who objects. And, you know, so I feel almost flattered, like, well, if you can't find any real arguments,
yeah,
you know, then you have to resort to that. And, I think there's only so long that can really last, those sorts of arguments. You know, it's very clear I'm not motivated by financial gain. I'm not being paid off by industry. And now, you know, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, the, you know, top medical journals have all written about my book now. And I think, so I'm no longer, I mean, I am just a journalist, but I'm a journalist who's has quite a bit of the medical establishment sort of swinging behind me now. Mm-hmm. So it's still a battle. I would say that really now the battle lines are really drawn with the vegan activist movement, which is very powerful, very well funded, and they really don't want people eating animal foods at all.
The opposite end of the scale, isn't it?
It is. And they're so active, and they don't want people eating meat. They don't like they don't want saturated fats out of the bottle, because saturated fats have always been the rate limiting factor on why people don't eat so much meat and cheese. And so they don't want that saturated fat being let out of jail. So that's really, I think, where the battle lines are now. You know, now it's not just, it's, you know, animal welfare activists and environmentalists, and it's really sort of losing, it's just a battle that is sort of, it's truly in like the alt-fact universe, let me just put it that way. It's really not based on a lot of, on science or data. It's just in a different sphere of debate.
Exactly, because it's a credit to the way you work that we discussed before, how before you publish your book, you tried to refute everything that you were saying. You made sure that those foundations were strong. You made sure that what you were saying was true. And, you know, your approach was, well, if I try my hardest and I can't refute it, then I'm not going to have people criticizing me for that. And that's exactly what you found, isn't it? They can't criticize you for your work, because it stands, and all they can resort to is trying to attack you personally.
Yeah. Well, I've grown a thick skin now. So even being just a journalist, and I think in some ways it is this continuation of trying to suppress the science, in the same way that scientists don't publish their results or bury them in a basement, or it's the same thing, which is trying to silence the science. If you can discredit the messenger, then you can silence the science that she talks about. And that is certainly, I think, their playbook. That's what they want to do. But it is a little bit now, you know, it's not just me. There's thousands of doctors all over the world now. It's just out of the bag now. And even if you silence me, it's just being carried on by so many people now.
And you're spreading the word further with the Nutrition Coalition.
Well, so I did, I founded this not-for-profit group, because when I realized that just my book alone would not cause all the scales to fall from everybody's eyes, as I had hoped, I founded a not-for-profit group called the Nutrition Coalition. And the idea was really to try to focus on the dietary guidelines in the United States, because they are so powerful. They're followed by nations all over the world. They are so important in determining what people think is a healthy diet. They really influence everything. They're just downloaded by every doctor, nutritionist, dietitian, nutrition. I mean, you think, oh, I don't get my dietary advice from a government website, but they're just downloaded to all the health professionals working on the front lines, every nurse. So, and they're widely considered the gold standard. And they're really not, for the reasons I told you. They buried the low carb literature, for example. They never reviewed any of those trials we discussed, for example. So our goal is to try to educate policymakers so that they understand what's gone wrong with the dietary guidelines. It's not the fault of average people themselves that they're fat and sick, but rather that they have been given the wrong advice, and that has to be fixed. So that's the work that group is doing.
And there's a wealth of information on the site. There are lots of studies listed and all sorts of things. You can go there and read more.
Yeah, it's nutritioncoalition.us for anybody who wants to go. And there's information there. There's a newsletter that we send out. And yeah, I think it's really important. It's important because for people listening, I mean, it's one thing you try to fix your own health. That's obviously your health, the health of your family. That's just number one priority. But then there's still like, well, what is the food you get at a hospital? And what about your elderly parent at a nursing home? And what about your child at school? And what about the military that's fighting for you? And by the way, we have an obesity problem in the military, and then we can't find enough fit people to fight. And you know, in all these arenas, all of that is controlled by our dietary guidelines. So they just have to change. You know, they have to, at the very least, they have to just at least allow there to be a low carb option. Mm-hmm. Just instead of saying this is a, right now, the official line is that is a dangerous fad diet. And it's not. It's supported by a large body of scientific literature. And so there should just be, that should just be one option, right? So, you know, and a few other things I could think of, like no more caps on saturated fats.
Well, if anyone can get those guidelines changed, I'm sure it's you.
Thanks for your confidence. But it does take a village.
Of course. And you've got plenty of really good people working with you, haven't you?
Well, I encourage everybody to go and sign up and be a part of it, because it really will take everybody speaking out. And so, yeah, for the future, for our children.
Yeah, the more numbers, we will affect change eventually. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you today, Nina. I wonder if you could wrap up with a top tip for our listeners.
Well, since you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, I've been thinking about this in the back of my mind. I think the best tip that I could offer for people in terms of eating is the one that I learned, which is that when you are craving sugar, which we all do, right? How many of us are really beyond sugar? Eat fat instead. That was one of the best things that I learned, where, you know, that late afternoon, oh, I'll just have something sweet. Just eat something fatty instead. It works every time. Even like just a bowl of whipped cream even, or, you know, you can be anything, but it's fat that really kills your sugar cravings. So, practical tip.
What it actually does is satisfy those cravings rather than feed them. Because, of course, right. If you listen to the cravings and eat sugar, you're going to have another craving half an hour later.
Right, exactly. But I think people just don't know. They just, you know, when you're hungry, you get so frazzled. Mm-hmm. So you just have to have a store of really great high fat things in your in your pantry.
Perfect. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you at Keto Fest.
Thank you. I look forward to meeting you too. And thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast. So please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on iTunes and Facebook. Every star and review really does help. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's quote is from Nina's book, The Big Fat Surprise. The observations line up. There are no paradoxes to explain. And if we can combine the lessons of both science and history, it seems that we may be able to make enlightened decisions about how to start down the path towards curing ourselves of chronic disease. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.